This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
You are listening to the Get Booked feed, where we are doing a whole big experiment thing. This is a special, unplanned, but very exciting, at least to me, bonus episode about algorithms. I am Jen Northington. I'm coming to you from Book Riot. And I am here with special guest Emily Pullen from the New York Public Library. Hello, Emily.
Hello, hello.
Welcome to Get Booked, sort of.
I'm very happy to be here. Very excited.
Yeah. So I will explain now a little bit about how this special extra episode came to be. Emily and I have known each other for more than a decade.
Definitely more than a decade. Yeah.
Possibly 20 years now. No, it can't be that long.
Maybe like 15.
Yeah.
Like
15 12. Is
12 to 15.
Yeah, something like that. We met when we were baby booksellers, working at different bookstores. I know,
and in different cities, in different parts of the country.
That's right. That's right. But it was a friendship that was meant to be, and our paths have since, you know, gone all over the place. We did get to work together in Word Bookstore in New York City for a while, but now, obviously, Emily is a librarian, and I saw her recently and we were talking about what was going on for us at work. And I mentioned this experiment to you and you were like, that's so funny because.
Hey, yo, I wrote my master's thesis about algorithms and bias and online recommendation tools.
So yeah.
it seemed like maybe it would be a good thing for us to talk about.
Yeah. So as y'all know, we're doing this experiment, right? We have the Hansel interviews with authors, and then we have our new recommendations show, which is coming in August, Human versus Algorithm. And I think, you know, we've talked on the show before about how algorithms are biased. We've recommended some books around that when people ask. But since we are actually going to be actively interacting with algorithms, and the more that Emily and I talked about it, and then, of course, you sent me your thesis and I was reading through it and I was like, this is so interesting. Like, we have to have Emily come on to the show and talk a little bit about what you learned. So if you... Oh, wait, before we do that, let us take a quick sponsor break.
Today's episode is brought to you by Entangled Publishing's Red Tower Books, publisher of the smash hit Fourth Wing. You'll only cross these blades once in a page-turning new tale of revenge strategy and so many lies. Best-selling Red Tower Books is releasing its next irresistible read that will capture your imagination and keep you guessing until the end. Mae Corlin's Five Broken Blades tells an intricate high-stakes tale of five total strangers united in a plot that will test their strength, wits, and courage. Each has their reasons, all have secrets. But while it's easy to betray a stranger, it's not so simple to stab a friend or a lover, okay, in the back. Now these five blades must choose between vengeance and one another. Pick up Five Broken Blades by Mae Corlin for a thrilling, adventurous tale filled with risk, romance, adventure, and, oh, so many lies. The relationships in it are complex and nuanced and involve everything from friends to enemies, found and biological family and lovers and more. Thanks again to Entangled Publishing's Red Tower Books, publishers of the smash hit Fourth Wing, for sponsoring this episode.
Okay, so now if you will sort of give us like the top level explanation of your thesis, like why did you decide to work on this? What was the question you were trying to answer?
So I want to clarify that it's not specifically about algorithms or the nitty-gritty of how they work, because that is not my area of expertise. It's really more of sort of a sociological or a cultural analysis of algorithms and other tools and things that pertain specifically to book people. So I have an interest in data, love using it, but I don't have a background in it. And interestingly, I feel like that the roots of that actually come from when I was really little, when there was kind of this unspoken message that you could either like the arts or you could like math and science, but you weren't really supposed to like both. And, you know, since I quite obviously was a huge reader and also loved music, it was pretty clear which path I should take. And then when I got to college, I did a little more in the social sciences, which is a little bit of, you know, kind of in the middle, but I didn't really ever get an opportunity to sort of marry the two. And I think that a lot has changed in the last 30 years, and it's not nearly so unheard of to kind of mix those together now. So that said, I wanted to hone in on the ways on ways to identify bias within the tools that we use every day. And since most of us aren't on the way to becoming data scientists,
right.
also offer possible ways to counterbalance that bias or find other tools that do a better job.
Yeah. And you, to like back up a second, you went from bookselling to librarianship, not in like necessarily a straightforward way.
No, absolutely not. So I can tell you a little bit about how I landed where I am in the NYPL, the New York Public Library.
Yeah.
So I kind of knew that I needed to pivot a little bit away from bookselling, but the most obvious solution that I found was at the time to work for the retail bookshop in the New York Public Library's main building, the Lyons Building, as
yes.
many of you might know it. and so I was working in the retail shop there for a number of years, but realized that because of the NYPL has a tuition reimbursement program, I could probably start my library degree. And I thought, you know, that's something that is of interest to me. So I kind of was able to have one foot in both worlds at the same time. And so I went to Queens College and was able to get my degree in about 2.5 years. And then right after I got my degree, a job position opened up that I actually had known about for a long time. Somebody else filled it for a while, and I had always wanted this job in the reader services department. And so right when I finished my degree, actually, that's not even true. It was before I finished my degree. This job opened up and I applied for it and I got it.
Yay.
And so it's in the reader services department, which focuses specifically on readers advisory, which is recommendations from librarians and making book lists and doing all sorts of things that I'm sure your listeners are pretty familiar with in the online space.
Yeah, I know we have a bunch of librarians who listen to the show. Shout out to librarians. And,
hey, yo.
and you know, I have seen notes from librarians like passing the show around the internet as like an example of this is like what readers advisory can look like, which is always extremely flattering to me because, you know, I hold librarians in high regard. But I think this is important to talk about just because, you know, whether or not we are experts in data science, which we are not. I mean, everybody knows I love a spreadsheet, but that does not make me a data scientist. and, you know, you're coming at it from this reader's advisory angle and an interest in numbers, but not an expertise. You know, we interact with these things all the time, every day, forever, right? And so I think that having any kind of understanding, you know, wherever we're starting, having an understanding and starting to ask these questions and poke at, you know, how they work and what they do a little bit is so important.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. They have such an impact on everybody's lives.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So, okay. So you were like, all right, so Reader's Advisory uses algorithms and I want to look at them.
Yes.
So what did that entail?
Yeah, so this is kind of jumping into some of the findings in a nutshell. And so I focused on Goodreads and Novelist, although it's hard to use two databases or two sort of sources that are really different. I liked the contrast that they gave, but I will I will say that Novelist, which if y'all don't know about it, you absolutely should, by the way, just a little plug here. It's an invaluable tool for librarians and a really fun toy for readers because they catalog books with expected terms like subject, genre, location, but then also appeal terms that relate to tone, pace, storyline, writing style, mood, character, and theme. So it's really fun to look up your favorite books and to see how they've cataloged them and to say, oh, wait a minute, I guess I do really like an atmospheric, cerebral novel with messy characters or something, you know?
I do like all of those things, Emily, I do.
Or if you happen to be a genre reader, they have really great designations for themes within genres. You know, so like you gotta love a good enemies to lovers romance, yes. or a grumpy sunshine romance. That's yes. a new one I've just learned about. But so, you know, so all of these themes and terms are really fun. So you should check out Novelist. Your public library may have a subscription to it. That's the best. That's how I access it. So anyway, Novelist ended up being kind of the main focus because they actually have really good cataloging and terms that you can analyze, and they're very transparent about those. So Goodreads, on the other hand, has a lot of user-generated tags, so that's its own beast. So I was able to use that a little bit, but not a lot. So I analyzed all the terms to an assigned title. I had a list of, I think, 25 that I was researching. As well as identity characteristics of the creators to see if I could observe trends about what kinds of terms and how many terms were assigned to male versus female authors, white versus BIPOC writers. And I found that books by BIPOC writers had slightly higher number of tags, and they were more clearly likely to be related to race or gender. So this touches on the idea of what is so, quote, normal that it doesn't even need to be tagged. And the answer in our culture is whiteness and maleness. And that in itself is problematic. So, you know, the question is, should whiteness have a tag as well as blackness? You know, what should these catalogers do in terms
of,
you know, so that was one thing that I was kind of looking into. Another is a thing that I called silo bias, where books by marginalized writers are tagged as such and compared to books by other marginalized writers much more frequently than they are compared to books by writers in various dominant groups. So books by women are compared to other books by women, but not to books by men that often. Books by lots of different, you know, BIPOC writers. So, you know, books by a Black author might be compared to a Latinx author, but typically there'll be a lot of overlap in terms of who they're compared to. And so if you think about it this way, the New York Times a couple years ago had a study that came out that said that 90%, but even though diversity in publishing is kind of getting a little bit better, maybe, 90% of books published in the United States are still written by white people. So that means, you know, if you think of that as a large globe, a large sphere, and then the other 10% of books published are written by all people of color. And you think about that as like the small little tennis ball sized sphere. And if you're only comparing people within that tennis ball sized sphere to each other, pretty limited, don't you think? So that's what I'm calling silo bias, which is sort of keeping separate, you know, this one certain kind of voice and not comparing it to the mainstream. So that's something that I was able to observe in a couple of different places.
Yeah, that's A, messed up. B, fascinating. C, like super interesting to think about how like, okay, so for example, you referenced, you know, Grumpy Sunshine as a type of romance. So when you think about that, like what you might get is if as you said, an author of color writes a grumpy sunshine romance, it's maybe less likely to get tagged with those tags. It might just be like romance and then like own voices, for example. Mm-hmm, and so mm-hmm. somebody looking for grumpy sunshine will have a harder time finding it.
Yeah. Yep, that's entirely possible. and let's see, did I get, I've got, yeah. So I did mention that, you know, that the like white writers tended to get tags that related more to sort of the style of writing.
Mm-hmm.
And BIPOC writers didn't get those nearly as often.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's really interesting, you know, and it's certainly not as much bias is, it's usually not intentional.
Right. Right.
you know, and especially when something is related to and based on algorithms.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of baked in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if the inputs that are coming into the algorithm.
Right.
have bias, then the outputs that come from the algorithm are going to recreate that bias.
Well, and humans are the one putting in the input. So of course, you yeah. know, humans have bias. Like that's just a truth. It doesn't matter who you are. You have biases.
Yeah, exactly. And then there was one more thing that, that I looked at in my research, which were read-alike suggestions.
Yes.
And what I call linkage terms. So terms that the seed title, the original one, and the read-alike suggestion have in common. And so with that, I created word cloud visualizations that are really fun for each title to see which terms occurred most frequently. And a word cloud is, you know, when some words are really big and that's because they've occurred repeatedly and some words are small, which means they only occurred once or twice.
Mm.
And so for BIPOC writers, the most commonly used linkage terms, so the reasons read-alike suggestions were suggested, were highly likely to relate to their marginalized status. So as you mentioned, own voices, culturally mm-hmm. diverse, African-American fiction, whereas books by white writers were more likely to have linkage terms that related to other appeals like writing style, tone, or character. So that's what I was alluding to earlier.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's also sort of an intentional decision on, you know, what parts of the writing to focus on.
Right, right.
So
and just to like, you know, get a little more specific, obviously on Goodreads, all of these terms are user generated, right? And we all know if we've ever been on Goodreads that like sometimes people will like say the same thing, but phrase it slightly differently or like, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. use a different spelling. And so then you have 6,000 tags that are all basically saying the same thing. And so yeah. that's really obvious how that happens. For something like novelist, I'm assuming this is like a cataloger's job? I know that there are such things as catalog librarians. Is that like who does this kind of work?
Yeah, like they've definitely got their own crew of librarians, and they work on you know, sort of developing their curated collection of titles and the tags that go with it. And in addition to the sort of algorithmically generated read-alike suggestions, they mm-hmm. also have various contractors and librarians who sort of do hand-selected read-alike suggestions as well.
Mm-hmm.
So they have a sort of a two-part system. Some of them are algorithms, and those you can always tell because one, they're not signed by a name.
Right.
And two, they will say something like, both of these books are, you know, contemporary romances that have, you know, interracial characters and
right.
grumpy sunshine.
Right, right.
You know, so you can just tell that, you know, they've pulled some of the terms and said both of these books have them.
Gotcha.
Whereas if an individual is creating it, that's when there is definitely some room for a little bit of serendipity there, a little mm-hmm. bit of unexpectedness, but all of those read-alike comparisons are vetted by the editors, like the content editors at Novelist. So, so you could, if essentially if you submitted one and it wasn't that great of a comparison, or, you know, they didn't think that it was up to snuff, then it wouldn't get approved.
Gotcha. There's a couple layers of work going on here. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. But, you know, all of that is sort of those read-alike suggestions are happening after the cataloging has already happened, you know, and like they also do a lot of work. They've recently updated some of their terminology uses and are working towards being more specific in terms of, author characteristics and how they identify and being, as is sort of the trend in terms of recognizing bias, is to be more specific rather than less specific.
Right.
And, you know, using umbrella terms, trying to avoid using umbrella terms when possible in favor of something that is more descriptive and more specific in terms of an identity.
Right. Because you don't want to just be lumping lots of different people into the same category.
Yeah.
Because they share a single generic, they are people of color. Like, that's a really reductive way to group people. Right.
Absolutely. Agreed. And that is, honestly, that's the weakness in my thesis, because it was a master's thesis that I had, you know, a semester to do, and it was in the middle of a pandemic.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I ended up having to do some of that lumping together that in a more rigorous study I wouldn't have done.
Right. So. Right. That's good to mention. I mean, I think it's also worth mentioning, and I know this just because I have so many friends who are librarians at this point in my life, but you have been part of this, and obviously your thesis is directly speaking to this. There are tons of conversations going on in librarianship about what is on the shelves? What do we display, right? Like, how are we cataloging things?
Yeah. Yeah. No, there's absolutely a lot of discussion, you know, and there's certainly a lot of room for individual librarians and branches and systems and various things to sort of highlight what's most important to them. But on the other hand, there's also a lot of discussion about the obligation to, make sure that there's something for all of your patrons.
Yes.
As opposed to just specific ones with a particular interest or a particular belief set. And so, that's definitely a conversation that's happening. And, you know, librarians who say, well, I feel like I have to have this problematic book here for reasons X, Y, and Z. And then the sort of answer sometimes is, yes, we can have it, but we don't need to promote it.
Right.
You know?
I know a lot of bookstores are also, you know, having those conversations. And personal weeding of my library, these are considerations I have. I think every reader is grappling with this. I do want to also point out, though we've been talking specifically about novelists here, with Goodreads, you're just at the mercy of crowdsourcing, which is, you know, you have no idea who's doing what, who's tagging what, and the vast majority of what those tags are going to be like. So it's a little bit, it's obviously more of a free for all. So,
And one other thing I'll mention about Goodreads is that when I was looking at, because they also have a, if you like this, you may also like that.
Yes. Yes.
Sort of a string of recommendations. And those, I had a really hard time figuring out rhyme or reason for them because some of them seemed fine in terms of their recommendations and some of them seemed odd, I guess is my professional official term for it.
Yes.
And it's like sometimes it might be, you know, maybe it's a self-published title that has a really huge, you know, fan following.
Right.
And so therefore, like, that book is going to show up, you know, somewhere that I wouldn't expect it to. Or sometimes I would look at a title, and especially if it was like a bestseller a couple years ago, there would be like a lot of the read-alike suggestions, or you might also like this, were other bestsellers from the same time period. And so that just like led me to think that there is something sales based. And I mean, it's kind of no secret that Goodreads is now owned by Amazon. So clearly they likely get a lot of their data and their feeds from a lot of that sales data. So there was something that felt pretty sales driven, sort of deep under the surface. But, and I'll mention this a little bit later, you know, there's no way to know what's going into their algorithm.
Right. So. All right. Well, before we get into the weeds on that, let us take another quick sponsor break. Okay. So I'm trying to decide. Let's talk about that. Well, no, let's talk about that later. First, let's talk about, so your thesis is specifically about librarianship and how librarians, especially in Reader's Advisory, use these tools. What do you wish non-professional readers understood about these recommendation algorithms?
Well, that they are not your friends. And I don't mean that in a nefarious way, although maybe I do. What I mean is that they don't know you like your friends and your family do, and like your favorite librarian or bookseller might come to know you and give recommendations based on that. So they, quote, know you, these algorithms, based on very specific blips of data. And they are far from perfect, especially when it comes to something like reading tastes.
Right.
So that's the main thing I think it's important to remember, is that, you know, there are definitely things that they can be useful for. And especially in this age of information where there is just so much data everywhere.
Yeah.
Like an algorithm can pare down that data. Mm-hmm. So it has its use, but it definitely requires us to remember that it doesn't know all the answers.
Right. Well, and that it wants to give us specific answers more than other answers for the reasons of whoever programmed it. Like, they might have good intentions. They might have sales intentions, as you said before. So yeah, there's all kinds of reasons why something might pop up. Well, I think this gets into my next question, which is, okay, so we're going to be utilizing recommendation algorithms very deliberately on our human versus algorithm experiment. So like, for those of us who are going to be hosts, you know, I do think it's interesting, like, what should we be keeping in mind as we go to source recommendations, with the understanding that, like, we're hoping they're not going to be as good as the personalized recommendation, but still, like, what should we be keeping in mind?
Sure. I think that, you know, I think that you humans, I think that the humans in this experiment may be able to bring in more influences and streams of knowledge than could possibly be programmed into an algorithm, especially on a commerce platform. But there are other recommendation places, which, like, I don't know if you've specifically set where your algorithm is going to come from.
So that's an interesting question. My plan was, and this is like early information for all of the listeners out there, my plan is to offer like a short list of suggestions to the hosts, but to like let them pick. And I don't, I'm also not going to specify, depending on which source, how you pick which recommendation. Like, like gonna let people, but the hosts are gonna have to explain to us what they did and why. So there will be an explanation for, like, okay, here's where I went and here's how I decided which one of these, you know, read-alikes or whatever I got recommended by to pick from this algorithm. So we will know, but I am, you know, I think I personally am going to play around with StoryGraph, because I think StoryGraph is really, StoryGraph is really interesting. I mean, it's far from perfect, right? No platform is perfect, but I do see.
And it's also very new.
It's super new. So they are still building their data sets, but like they have, I didn't know they were called appeal terms, but they have these appeal terms baked into it. Right. And like, this actually is good motivation for me on my secret account to start adding, like, they're like, oh, what terms do you want to add? And I often skip that. I'm like, I don't know what that is. But now I'm like, oh, I should be adding those. Like, I should be helping the algorithm grow. Right. So anyway, I digress. So when we're like out here playing with algorithms for these recommendations, like, I guess it'll be different depending on what platforms we're on, what we should keep in mind.
I think so, yeah. You know, because I definitely found ones that were more useful and ones that were less useful. And, you know, StoryGraph is definitely interesting because it sort of weighs heavy on those appeal terms, but most specifically the ones that are kind of more about mood and tone, you know, and sort of pace, maybe, like how fast it reads or how slow it reads.
Yes.
And so, you know, it's really nice to have, and that is especially, I will say that's especially helpful with fiction.
Yes.
You know, I think that historically things like Library of Congress headings and Dewey headings have done a real disservice to fiction. Like the subject headings that are listed is like, you know, oh gosh, I liked The Vanishing Half. And it's like, oh, well, you might like another book that's you know, about a singer in Los Angeles, and you're like, that's one character for like one part of the book, but it's like listed as a subject heading. It's like, oh, you liked this book, you might like other books about twin sisters,
right?
You know, it's like, well, that wasn't really the part of it that I was really drawn to. So subject headings aren't usually that helpful when it comes to fiction. They might be, but usually you're not looking for a subject, you're looking for a feeling or a, you know, a type of character maybe. And so I think that those appeals, you know, are really useful. So, you know, and maybe it's I have found things are different for nonfiction than fiction, and certain sources might be more useful for things in nonfiction than otherwise. So, so yes, there's definitely a lot out there. I guess that's no surprise.
No doubt. Yeah. I think it'll be super interesting to see what hosts choose and why. Like that's going to be one of the fun parts of this experiment, is seeing what that ends up looking like. And I'm, you know, I feel like I could put good money on everybody being approaching it a slightly different way, in the same way that like we all approach personalized recommendations a little bit differently. Right. So.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And yeah, I love that. I think that even professional book recommenders approach their recommendations differently.
Oh yeah.
You know, and like one of the conversations about, neutrality in librarianship and whether it exists or is possible or is even desirable, you know, is, you know, do we have an obligation to recommend exactly what a person says that they want? Or do we have an obligation to, you know, uplift marginalized voices? Or do we have an obligation to push a reader's boundaries in some way, as opposed to reinforce what they already know?
Right.
And so like that's definitely a question and something that I think about regularly in terms of what I'm recommending. And that's part of why I always try to recommend 3 books for somebody, because that allows me to have a little bit of flexibility in terms of, yeah, I have a whole strategy I won't go into today, but you know, I think that it's useful to be able to recommend something that's exactly what they think they want, and something that's a bit outside of that, which can help to recreate some of that serendipity that people love when browsing.
Right. Yeah, this is one of the things that, I mean, especially, you know, long-term listeners will know, we will occasionally go very off on a tangent with a request and be like, so I know this isn't exactly what you asked for, but, and then have a big long story about how they should read it anyway. And sometimes we're like, okay, this is exactly what you're looking for. And so, yeah, I mean, we've done everything along that spectrum, I think, on this show in the past, and my money is again on us continuing to do that in the future. Okay, one more question about algorithms for you. Can we, like, as readers, as consumers, as whatever we are in our daily lives, can we help make them better? Like, are there things that we can do? I mean, I guess obviously I can fill out those StoryGraph appeal terms, right? So that's like one very specific example.
Sure. Yeah, I wish I had a more concrete answer for this question, because algorithms work because of huge amounts of data. So changing one thing that one person does isn't likely to change all that much unless you are somebody who creates them or works for the companies that, you know, make them ubiquitous.
Mm-hmm.
So in her book, Weapons of Mass Destruction by Kathy O'Neill, so she writes that one of the worst things about algorithms is their opacity, what she calls the black box.
Mm.
So many of them are deemed proprietary by companies and can therefore be kept secret. So we can't tell what inputs algorithms use to determine which students are likely to perform poorly on standardized tests, which formerly incarcerated persons are likely to reoffend, or to suggest books which you might like based on others that you bought.
Mm.
So not being able to tell what the inputs are, it makes it really difficult to know how to tackle that.
Right.
So I think that one way is supporting and reaching out to smaller companies rather than the huge behemoths who own the internet.
Mm.
Because you might be able to, one, get more information about some of those things and have an impact on how they do things, or at least ask the questions.
Right.
And also fighting for algorithms to be open source might be another place to start.
Yeah.
Or you can do kind of what I mentioned at the beginning to come back full circle. You can start with learning to see bias where it already exists,
mm-hmm.
both in yourself and in the tools you use every day, and then work to counterbalance. So, for example, if I'm with a reader who loves a specific white male thriller writer, and novelist read-alike suggestions are all other white male thriller writers, which has definitely happened to
yes.
me a lot,
mm-hmm.
I can counterbalance that bias, which could be the algorithm. It might be in ourselves. It might be in the publishing industry, or might be all three.
Mm-hmm.
We can counterbalance by suggesting at least one book by a woman, at least one book by a person of color, in addition to the suggested read-alike titles. So that's something for folks who are sort of in a position to regularly be recommending books, or even like you're talking to your parents or your mom
mm-hmm.
has a book club, you know, like mm-hmm. you can recommend the like most obvious, you know, thing that's on Good Morning America, but you
right.
can also suggest a few things that might not be what they think they want, but maybe they do.
Yeah.
So,
all
yeah.
right. Well, that's, I like that though. That is, I mean, yes, we can't individually fix these systemic problems, right? Like that's just true of so many things in life right now. There's only so much we as individuals can do, but being aware, asking the questions, and then doing what we can in our own lives is definitely the way to start.
Absolutely. Agreed with you there.
Yeah. All right. So last but not least, I have to ask you, what are you reading right now?
Absolutely. Always the question of the hour.
Yeah.
So I just finished a debut novel called What We Do in the Dark by Michelle Hart. I read it in 24 hours. This is the first time I've done that in a long time.
Mm.
And to be honest, I kind of thought I wasn't going to like it because I like read the premise and was just like, oh gosh, I've read this before.
Right.
Like I've definitely heard of the like, you know, undergrad student has affair with professor trope.
Mm.
Like, yes, I've heard it all before, but I was surprised and impressed with this. It kind of takes the understated language and emotions of like a Katie Kitamura book.
Mm-hmm.
And then it adds in a dash of Patricia Highsmith's The Price of Salt,
mm-hmm.
minus toxicity and the drama. Cerebral coming of age that ended up really taking me in. It felt like a good summer read, even though it definitely deals with heavy stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the fiction that I've read most recently. I'm usually reading three or four things at once. So one other one that I'll tell you about is coming out in September in nonfiction. It's a forthcoming memoir called Solito by Javier Zamora. And he's a man who made the harrowing journey from Central America to the United States as a young child. But what I'm finding so intriguing so far about this is the voice. It actually reads like fiction in a strange way. He's telling it from the perspective of his 8-year-old self.
Mm.
So we get his boredom of living with his grandparents while he waits for his parents to send for him because they've gone before him. His unbridled excitement when he finally gets the call, his limited understanding of the complexities and dangers that surround him traveling from Central America, like with a coyote to the United States. And he's really propelling the reader forward with him as an 8-year-old, rather than looking back with the full benefit of hindsight and maturity, which is what you often get in memoirs. So I'm you know, maybe halfway through, but I'm just finding it really interesting and compelling that decision to put the perspective where he did. So
yeah, how like intense. That's, I mean, it would be intense no matter what, but that's extra double plus intense. Yeah, that's an appeal term, right? Extra double plus intense. That's definitely
The novelist. I think I've seen that one. If not, it should be.
Well, thank you so much. You have like a lot going on in your life right now, so I really appreciate you taking the time to come talk to us.
This is a breath of fresh air. I'm absolutely excited to follow the experiment. I can't wait to see if it's Watson or Ken Jennings that's gonna win.
Yeah. My money is on the humans. Honestly, obviously I have a stake in that, but I do think it's gonna be super interesting. So
I will definitely be listening, and thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thank you. If people are interested in, like, you know, following you on the internet, is that a thing they can do?
That's totally a thing they can do. My handle on Twitter and Instagram is Corpus Libris. I'll spell it for you. It's at CORPUSLIBRIS. And that's where I'm on the internets.
Awesome. Awesome. Emily has cats, I'm just going to tell you all. So, you know, in case you needed extra incentive to follow her.
Cats and books, that's mainly what it is. And
that's right. That's our
cane cone.
Yeah, that's our brand. All right. So let's see. Thanks to you for coming. Thank you all for listening. I hope that you will tell us what your thoughts are about this experiment. Email us, getbooked@bookriot.com. As always, you can get human-generated book recommendations at bookriot.com. You can listen to our other human-generated podcasts at bookriot.com/listen. And yeah, we'll talk to you next time.